It is 8:30, and we are joined once again by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
So, did you catch the debates last night? Good. I see Jav did.
Yeah.
Yes, I did, actually.
Yes, I did too.
And you're still amongst us,
yes,
Maria.
Yes. No, that's a myth. The last debate made me sick. Did not make me sick.
Didn't make you physically
sick. And we will not be taking questions from the town hall audience this morning either. The format of I thought the questions were better last night, but the format was basically the same as it was for the first debate, and many of the answers were the same as they were in the first debate. I thought it was very similar in terms of the content. And, of course, one of the downsides to these debates, as near as I can tell, is that so much of the parsing of these debates has to do with the style points. Was he grimacing? Was he smiling? Were they playing to the audience in particularly the right way? And not really focusing on the very real and substantive, differences in what the two men are actually saying. Of course, there are some areas where they're not saying anything very different at all. Israel-Palestine coming to mind, but the whole gushing over the format last night just seems to be pretty misplaced to me. It didn't really seem to be very different from what the first debate was about.
No, it wasn't, and there were some real glaring omissions, just like there was in the first debate. For example, no mention was made of the actual situation on the ground in Iraq, even though there was a lot of talk about Iraq. There was this, at least in my view, a perception that neither of these two guys is willing to talk about the real problem.
Yeah, Kerry talked about that much more in the first debate, but mm-hmm. he did not talk about it last night.
Yeah, so very little mention of what's actually going on there, or concrete steps on what needs to be done. You know, I mean, beyond Kerry's saying that, we need more troops and we need international allies, and George Bush saying, well, we got a plan, we'll go it alone, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, and neither one of them is mm-hmm. particularly realistic. I mean, Bush has a point when he says that the allies aren't gonna just follow along blindly with Kerry. I mean, it's it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
And things are not going well on the ground in Iraq, as we'll talk about.
Yeah.
I thought I was fairly impressed with Bush being much more coherent last night, although I hesitate to use that word. But
I want to know how many different internets we have personally. But
I'd also like to know, what's the real first name of Prime Minister Berlusconi of Italy? Is it Sergio or Servio or is it Silvio?
Wasn't that a Saturday morning cartoon character?
Sergio Berlusconi? I don't know.
Anyway. Actually, I think that's one of the Mario Brother characters.
Well, oh, okay. We know. I mean, when you see stuff like that, you really have to realize that my question was, gee, has Bush ever used the internet? I mean, you have to kind of know how to read to use the internet.
Well, no, he's been boycotting it ever since he learned that Al Gore invented it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's jump over to some different elections that, or supposedly elections that are happening in Afghanistan.
Yeah, elections going on today in Afghanistan. The first elections in forever. Is that actually not true? Afghanistan has had a democracy in the past, although not for the past 25 years. What's going on in Afghanistan today can scarcely be confused with the idea of a democracy, particularly since there's been virtually no investment by the United States in any kind of civil society building over the past 2.5 years. What we've got is a presidential election in which...
Originally, there was supposed to be a full election, right, for parliament
Well,
and everything.
Yeah, and this is an election that's been postponed 3 times. And then there was originally supposed to be a full election. Now it's a presidential election. The parliamentary elections are supposed to take place sometime early next year. What that is left for a setup, and we'll talk about this in the context of the Iraqi elections also, there's a real tendency by President Bush, particularly in the debates and on his stump speeches, to make this very sharp black and white, dichotomy that he draws between the evildoers who don't want elections and free and fair elections that people who are striving for democracy and freedom and liberation want. You know, it's not that simple, you know, the ballot versus the bullet. In this case, you have the warlords who actually still control most of Afghanistan are lining up, and they're lining up. In particular, some of them have fielded candidates in the presidential election essentially as bargaining chips for portfolios in a future government administration. So that what you're seeing is a transition from the present situation where we have the interim president, Hamid Karzai, is the CIA employee, the U.S. puppet who's over there, where he essentially is doing these deals with these different warlords to leave him in power in Kabul. He'll take Kabul and they'll take various other parts of the country and, you know, can grow their opium and flood the world with heroin and so forth. So instead of having that present situation, what we'll move to is a situation where they will have portfolios in the future government. They'll have a ministry of this or a ministry of that and can be paid off that way. So it's very corrupt and it has very little to do with democracy. But that's the situation that we're seeing with the elections today.
Yeah, I also want to say too that George Bush has bragged that over 10. Million is the figure he used. Over 10 million Afghanis have registered to vote. The UN personnel on the ground in Afghanistan say that, well, yes, over 10 million are registered to vote, but that's because many people in Afghanistan have registered twice or more than twice. So that's going to give you some idea of what kind of corruption is going to be part of this upcoming election.
Yeah, and additionally that registration is not spread evenly throughout the country. There are vast segments of the south and southeast part of the country that are beyond the reach of the government, areas where the Taliban is particularly strong, where registration has been very sparse.
And the Taliban also has the ability to disrupt elections in other parts of the country, not just in the south and southeast. In fact, they have staged attacks even in the capital city of Kabul. So there's possibility of incredible violence, too.
Yeah, they're very concerned about that today.
So
let's move on.
All right. Well, let's move over then to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
I want to talk about a couple of the reports that came out this week. Now, there's been a lot of information around about the Dulfer report. That's Charles Dulfer, who is the head of the Iraq Survey Group. He replaced a man named David Kay early this year when David Kay, the original head of the Iraq Survey Group, quit out of frustration and futility. David Kay had said that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that they could find, and he hinted that the search was basically a political sham because his inspection teams were being either being sidelined, not given any work to do, or they were being reassigned to hunt down insurgents. Now, Charles Dulfer came on, and George Bush mentioned this summer that the Dulfer report would be the final report on whether there were any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now, this report that he's issued has basically come up with exactly the same conclusions that David Kay came up with, exactly the same conclusions that Hans Blix and the UN weapons inspectors came up with. There is literally no difference at all in their conclusions that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
And not only were there none at the time of the invasion, but there weren't any going back 10 or more years.
Yeah, and that the original UN weapons inspectors in the early 1990s basically found and destroyed anything that there was to find, and that the biological weapons that Saddam Hussein had destroyed because the weapons inspectors were on the trail and just about ready to find them, those biological weapons were pretty much totally destroyed and that there weren't any seed stocks left laying around. Now, as for resuming production after the sanctions lifted, that's a point that George Bush keeps saying, well, if we had lifted the sanctions, Saddam still had the ability to reconstitute his weapons programs. Dulfer was very specific. He wrote, and I'm going to quote this directly, "The former regime had no formal written strategy or plan for the revival
Thank
of
you.
Weapons of mass destruction after sanctions. Neither was there an identifiable group of weapons of mass destruction policymakers or planners separate from Saddam. So what he's saying is that what it boils down to is it's George Bush saying what he thinks Saddam Hussein was thinking at the time.
It's speculation, and nothing more than speculation.
Now, there's another thing that George Bush likes to say when he makes his excuses for the invasion of Iraq. He likes to say that, well, Saddam Hussein would have given weapons of mass destruction to terrorists. Now, there was a second report issued this week by the CIA that said that as for giving weapons of mass destruction to terrorists, they said that Saddam Hussein had no credible links to al-Qaeda, and that it was not even clear that there was any link between Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and Saddam Hussein's government. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi is the Jordanian terrorist that the U.S. wants everyone to think is responsible for most of the violence in Iraq today. So that's the second report. So there goes that excuse out the window. Now, there was another report issued this week that I think is even more important than those two reports, and I say that because we've been telling people those things for a couple years now, and that they were pretty obvious from the beginning.
There was one other thing in the Dofer report that I wanted to mention.
Okay, go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, that we had the revelation that a number of companies, including a number of American companies, were trading on the oil vouchers that Saddam Hussein was giving out as part of the Oil for Food program. Now, in the part of the Dofer report, in the version of the Dofer report that was made public, the names of the American companies were redacted for privacy concerns, but those names were given to Congress and they have been leaked out. They include Chevron, the company that at the time of this, from 1996 to 2001, had an oil tanker named after Condoleezza Rice. We had Mobil, Texaco, and Bay Oil, and then three additional oil investors, one in Texas and two in Michigan, I believe. And So here you have American companies, American oil companies, the same oil companies who helped write Dick Cheney's energy policy in 2001, or many of the same ones, trading essentially with Saddam Hussein's government. It's extremely hypocritical, and that has gotten virtually no attention in the media.
Yes, that's true. Now, I want to talk about this third report that came out that has gotten very little attention that I think is far more important. The State Department issued a report saying that less than 7% of the funds that Congress allocated to be spent on reconstruction in Iraq have been spent so far. Less than 7%. Now, in January, George Bush said that $12.7 billion would be spent by October 1st. Well, October 1st rolled around, and only $1.22 billion has been spent so far. So now the question is, where has it gone? Out of the $4.4 billion that was budgeted for the electrical system in Iraq, only $300 million has been spent. Of the $2.3 billion budgeted for water projects and sanitation, a very, very important problem for Iraq right now, only $19 million has been spent. Of the $786 million budgeted for health care, rebuilding hospitals, providing medicines and necessary equipment to treat Iraqis, only $2 million has been spent. Only $2 million on health care. And this is the shocker. It's not all been spent on rebuilding and reconstruction either. Now, when they looked at what the money has actually been spent on, they came up with the following breakdown. About 30% was spent for security. That's a conservative estimate. Some folks who've looked at the numbers say they think it's more than 50% of that money has gone for security. That means paying private security contractors, buying weapons and body armor, paying for armored vehicles and armored transport and bodyguards, etc. 6% of the money has been spent strictly for profits paid to contractors like Halliburton and Bechtel and other companies. 12% has gone for insurance because Iraq is a dangerous place and you got to insure your employees. 12% for insurance and for paying non-Iraqi personnel, so that's management salaries, Americans and Kuwaitis and Saudis, etc. 10% was diverted to the Coalition Provisional Authority and U.S. Embassy costs, so that's 10% taken right off the top, paid right back into American pockets. And 15%, a full 15%, they think, has gone for corruption, fraud, and mismanagement. So that leaves less than one quarter of the funds spent so far have been spent on the actual rebuilding and reconstruction projects in Iraq. That's a shocking number. It's a shocking
and less
report.
Than less than one quarter of the money that the sum total of the money, the sum total was actually far less than should have been spent.
Yeah, it's less than 7% of what was supposed to be spent, and only a quarter of that or less for reconstruction itself. Now, that's not going to get any better, because security is not getting any better in Iraq. Neither is oversight, so the whole fraud and mismanagement problem is not going to get... That chunk taken out of there is not going to get any less either. Now, I just want to mention a couple of other little things, too.
Yeah, from what I understand, the reconstruction work in Iraq is basically ground to a halt because of security implications.
Yes.
It's virtually impossible for particularly Westerners to work at all in Iraq on the field because it's simply too dangerous.
I'm going to talk about that here, too, in just a second.
Okay.
Now, there's a couple of other things I want to mention. The NATO alliance's top commander said this week that NATO training of Iraqi troops won't even begin until the end of this year. Won't even begin until the end of this year. So we can just look at George Bush's other assertion about Iraq, that 120,000 Iraqi security forces are going to be trained by the end of this year. And you just got to shake your head and say, what world is he living in? You know? The main problem, the main reason why NATO can't begin their training is because France and Germany and Russia are not sending any personnel to Iraq for any reason, and not part of the NATO contingent that's going to train Iraqi security forces either. So now NATO has to go around and ask all these other little countries to donate a few personnel here, a few people here, a few troops there, etc., etc. So that's going to take some time, and it's not going to be until the end of the year that it even gets underway. Now, the other thing I want to mention is that as for elections in January, UN staff have asked, this week, they have asked the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan to pull all UN staff out of the country, which could very definitely scuttle elections for January. They cited an unprecedented risk to their lives with daily car bombings and kidnappings and the beheadings of foreign workers in Iraq. Now, UN election personnel, they would have to travel around the countryside in order to hire local election officials, in order to set up registration and monitor the elections, and that makes them a very tempting target for the guerrillas. There are no UN troops in Iraq. There's only US troops and British troops to guard the UN election monitors, and that again makes them another target of violence. And so the UN workers, the 35 UN workers, a very, very small contingent right now in Iraq, they are confined to the green zone in Baghdad. They haven't been able to go outside the green zone. Now, if security gets worse before the elections, as Donald Rumsfeld has said, the UN monitors who are there now won't be able to do their jobs.
And, you know, when we talk about these elections being some sort of a panacea, you know, we're less than 3 months away from those supposed elections. Who's running? Who's actually in those elections? We have no idea.
That hasn't started yet.
No.
And it can't start.
It can't start.
Can't start unless the security situation improves. Well, letting you think about that for a moment. But there are a lot of things that have to happen for an election to go forward, not just the registration of voters. By the way, in something that I would have talked about last week, the UN election monitors have suggested the same strategy that I discussed as being very, very possible in 2003 when elections should have started and the U.S. delayed. When the insurgency was just starting to ramp up, I said, look, you got to have elections or this is going to happen. Well, I said that the elections are possible if they take the roles of people who got aid through the UN food program and they used that as the registration rolls, then they could have an election right away. And the U.S. said, no, we can't do that because those are not accurate. Well, the U.N. has now said, well, that's how we're going to do this upcoming election. We're going to use the U.N. food program rolls. And yes, they are. They do happen to be very accurate.
So why couldn't we have
so
had the elections?
So why couldn't we done it more than a year ago?
When it was safe.
Yeah, when there was better security and people really wanted to vote and really were excited perhaps excited about the idea of democracy in Iraq.
Yeah,
maybe some other elections factored into that.
Well, and I mean, speaking of that, I mean, the question isn't whether there's going to be elections in January. The question is whether the facade of elections in January can be maintained until after the elections in November. That's what this is really all about. I mean, you know,
and at this point,
can we maintain the facade that there are going to be elections in Iraq in January long enough for George Bush to get reelected? That's what this is about.
Yeah, and at this point, it's looking pretty ridiculous.
All right. Anything else on Iraq?
No, let's move on.
All right. The Indy Media Centers had some visits this weekend.
Yeah, they're in trouble once again. Indy Media has made a career out of this. And this is probably the most serious run-in that Indy Media, the independent media centers, have had with authorities so far. The FBI, acting on behalf of an unnamed third country, probably Italy or Switzerland, visited the offices of Rackspace, a UK company that hosts the sites for Indy Media for a number of its sites in Europe and South America, 20 sites overall, and took the hard disks, the hard drives, two of the hard drives, so that those sites are down now for Indy Media. Now, this is supposedly, although this has not been confirmed, and apparently there's a gag order in place that prevents Rackspace from talking about this. So the IMC does not even know what this is about right now. They haven't been given any criminal charges. They haven't been told what the investigation is about. All they know is that they're out of business. But what this is apparently about is that an IMC site in France, the Nantes site, posted a photo of a demonstration at which they identified undercover Swiss police officers. And Switzerland has complained about this, saying that this represents a threat to the safety of the police officers, yada yada. Nonetheless, the extreme action of taking that site and nearly a couple dozen additional sites, plus internet radio stations and a number of other unrelated sites off of the internet, without any kind of due process that anybody is aware of. We don't know that whether there's a court order about this or whether there's just an investigation underway. It really comes across as journalistic harassment, and at a global scale on this. We're talking several different countries cooperating in this investigation in order to take Indy Media off the air. So this is something we want to keep an eye on and see what happens to those sites and what happens to Indy Media.
Yeah, it seems kind of counterproductive in a way, if they really didn't want that stuff, you know, being distributed, that now people will be hunting down those photos and reproducing them across, you know,
yeah,
a
once
lot more
it,
sites.
It really, it draws attention to it, yeah.
Once it's up on the internet, it's up, I mean, it's going to be more than one place.
Yeah, it's the genie's out of the bottle.
Yeah, yes. You're not putting it back, so.
That's right.
The other thing was, you said the FBI went
Yeah,
in?
The FBI...
They didn't send it to Scotland Yard, since it's over in the UK?
No, the FBI, there were... it's a UK company, but the hard drives themselves are actually located in Virginia.
Okay.
So that's...
All right.
So, well, we don't know where the hard drives are now, but that's where they were located.
That's where they were last seen.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. All right. Well, Maria, last week, had you been here, you were going to give us the poop on the city budget here.
Yes,
for
on the
Seattle.
City budget. I can do a really brief, just talk about a couple of the main points on the city budget. Mayor Greg Nickels released his draft of the city budget. It's going to go to the city council. They make changes. They discuss it. They vote it up or down, and then that's what becomes law. Now, and Mayor Greg Nickels decides whether or not he's going to sign it or whether he's going to veto it. Now, the budget that he released, and it's on his website. If you go to the City of Seattle website, and the mayor's got his budget proposal up there. You can look at it directly. The couple things that struck me is that they're counting on revenues. Now, every budget has two sides. It has your income side, which is called revenue, or your tax collections. Or, you know, there are other things too, like license fees and permits that are inflows, your income. And then it has the outflows or expenses, what you pay out. Now, on the revenue side or the income side, what I noticed is that the city is counting on the economic recovery not only to continue, but to increase. This was a problem last year as well, that they were counting on the economy to recover at a rate that it was not obviously going to recover. Now, I just want to point out that they're counting on a 3.25% increase in revenue. However, this year so far, there's been more like a 1.9% increase, and there's every sign that the economy is starting to stall again. Now you have to look at things like the retail sales tax collections. If you look at the budget that they have up, the little graph that they have up on their website, retail sales have been going down for 4 years in a row. Suddenly, in 2005, they show them shooting up again. That's just not sustainable, and that's something that I think people ought to complain about. Now, on the expense side, I can't go into a lot of detail because there's not much time, but I just want to tell you that nearly everything takes a cut except for police and fire services and certain administrative expenses, like, for example, the mayor's office. Now, parks take a 4% cut. Community development block grants take a 7% cut. Human services department, this is something that folks should complain about too, they take an 18% overall cut, and the health department takes a 20% cut. However, the way the budget is written, all the numbers are juggled around between categories. Some categories are zeroed out, new categories are added back in. So it is very, very, very difficult to tell what has actually been cut. That is highly dishonest. Should be laid out in a format where we can see what's been cut and what's not been cut. But obviously there was something going on there to kind of hide things, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of cuts to social services. There's also a lot of new user fees that are going in, parking and places like Seward Park.
Mm-hmm, parking in for parks, if you want to use the park.
The conservatory would have a $5 admission fee now. There's just a lot of little things like that that are adding up and that are, in some cases, establishing precedent for future user fees.
Yeah, and so you'd have to ask, where is that new money going? Because there is an overall increase in the budget this year. Where's the new money going if all of these departments are getting cut? Well, police and fire department get a pay raise and additional personnel, while city personnel are being cut. More money is going into the police pension fund, gets a 10% increase, while the rest of city employees, their pension gets a, I think it's an 18% cut. It's a big cut. Now, has to be that enormous City Light refund paid. That's in there. That's going to take up a lot of that money. There's also a huge increase in bonds debt service. That's because the city is going to be issuing new bonds for things like Pier 59, Pier 62, 63. There's no detail of what the work is going to be done on those places, just saying that they're going to issue lots of new bonds that they're going to have to pay for. New parking pay stations, Mayor Greg Nickel's big boondoggle, Mercer Street improvements, the Alaskan Way Viaduct. So a lot of that money's going into debt service for fancy new projects that are not being discussed out in the open.
Well, maybe the mayor and the deputies would be willing to move back their salary from six figures to five figures to help pay for some of this.
That's not going
to
cover it.
And they're not going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
It'd be a nice gesture. All right. Well, unfortunately, with that, we are out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
You can find it at bookstores and cafes, places where you find free periodicals. It's a free newspaper that comes out every couple weeks with local and global news and humor and opinion. You can also find it on the web, our current issue and all of our back issues, at www.eatthestate.org. And you can help us out. We are a largely volunteer publication that can use people to help distribute, to help write, to help sell ads, do all sorts of things. Check us out. Our Our phone number is area code 206-903-9461.